Welcome to another edition of the podcast, in the TIFF edition. We're talking about the Toronto International Film Festival, and I have with me Katie Rich from Cinema Blend.
Sadly, never in Canada.
Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
I never blame Canada.
And Angelo Merida from Film Freak Central.
I live in Canada.
Hey!
Katie is going to host today.
I may be here too now as well. Tim from Daily Telegraph, can you hear me?
Tim, I thought you were arriving later. And we also have Tim Roby from the Telegraph.
It was like you were lurking in the background waiting to introduce yourself at the most stunning moment.
I could have really, a bit more suspense would have been good, I think. But
I guess to start really basically, this is just, you know, me not having gone to Toronto, I'm constantly quizzing people on what they saw that was interesting, what they saw that was good. And to start briefly and to kind of, you know, especially for our guests to give listeners a sense of your taste, what was the big thing that you saw that you took away? Like, what's the one that you spent the whole festival telling people they had to see? I guess start with Angelo as one of our guests.
I really liked The Strange Little Cat, which was in the Wavelengths program, which I actually only just saw, I think, yesterday in the morning. A very strange debut from Berlin that's basically entirely set in a cramped apartment that has these three generations of one family just basically sort of roving in and out of rooms. And I don't know how much more I should say. It's sort of one of those little mysteries that you kind of don't want to spoil for people, but it's kind of wonderful.
I love the title of it.
Is it one of those movies that transcends its gimmick? Because it sounds a little bit like a novelty.
I think the fact that it's really short and compressed, I mean, it only runs 72 minutes. It kind of doesn't wear out the gimmick. And there's enough going on screen that's sort of wonderful and strange that you kind of never feel like you're sitting through an exercise.
Now, we've got one intense cat person and one big-time dog person in this podcast. So is this movie going to hit them against each other in some way?
There is a cat that stares at a dog and purrs lovingly in front of it for a good 5-minute sequence in this 72-minute film. So you will be satisfied.
Well, let that be a lesson to us all. That's good.
The dog gets a great close-up as well on the street outside. And I like the dog as much as the cat, I think. But that movie, I'm really glad I caught it. So that was definitely one of my favorites. But I've got to say, the film that bowled me over and which I ended up seeing twice was 12 Years a Slave.
Mm.
Just think it's astonishing.
And that is one I've actually seen. So
good.
Is there anything in particular that made that blow you away?
I guess what I was slightly worried about was that we were going to get kind of high-handed Steve McQueen again. It feels to me as though his other two films, much as I admire them, he kind of takes the material and he sort of imposes this very kind of radical aesthetic stamp from above onto them. And I thought, in fact, that was the stuff in Shame that kept it interesting, was his approach to the material, which was in itself a bit dubious. Whereas here, it's almost like he's sort of gone the other way. He's realized that the material he's got in Solomon North's autobiography is so powerful and such a kind of great conduit for empathy that he doesn't mess with it, and he actually allows his style to kind of seep into it slowly from the beginning. And so sort of by crucial points in the movie, you're totally emotionally involved. And then only at the end of a shot, you realize, oh my God, that was one long take. And I am completely in the thrall of Steve McQueen's style here without him advertising it from the first second of that shot.
How many of you guys also saw 12 Years a Slave?
I saw it when I got back to New York while the festival was still going. So it's part of my TIFF experience, but it feels like a little out of body since I wasn't actually in Canada when I saw it.
Accounts. And Nick, you have not caught it yet?
No, because it was not 4 hours or set in China, so no.
You're a hardcore man.
Yeah.
I actually tried to balance that out, like, as to Nick's joke there. Like, I was trying to see a little bit of the more mainstream things, though a lot of them, even like 12 Years a Slave, is mainstream, is maybe a stretch of that definition.
Yeah.
I didn't have one thing that sort of defined the festival for me, but I really, like, the movie I keep thinking about is Tom at the Farm.
Okay, I don't know anything about that.
And that is the new one from Xavier Dolan.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone who you can see his cinematic influences all the time. He's a young filmmaker. You know, so it's about, like, he's, like, putting his DVD collection on screen. Somebody was joking with me about that. But I thought this one was much different than his last one, and I'm really excited that you can see him developing as his career goes, and this one's kind of like a thriller, but it definitely feels like something he would do.
Is that set to come out anytime soon? Do we know anything about the release?
I'm still not sure I Killed My Mother ever opened in the U.S. It's a bit of a mystery. Who knows?
It just came out this spring, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it took like 3 years. Yeah.
This is the most commercial, though, I would say, of all of them. So if anyone's likely to make it, I would say Tom at the Farm probably has a shot at proper distribution. I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit too utopian there.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least it's a genre that distributors find easily marketable in a way, even if the movie itself is not exactly.
Might say, even our friend Guy Lodge liked this one in Venice, and he has not been such a big fan of the last couple, so it sounds like I'm really excited to see it. I don't know when I'll get the chance.
Might even convince the converts. And Nick, I guess you wrap things up with your pick.
I'm sort of in love with two, but one of them is at Berkeley, which is this long documentary about the campus of University of California at Berkeley. And since I teach at a college, I'm maybe a little bit pre-sold to be fascinated by something that I still can't tell how fascinated everybody else will be, although everyone I talked to who saw it really loved it. But it's a pretty amazing sort of cross-section of what faculty and administrators and students are all thinking about at different times, and what we think power is and what we think knowledge is these days. But maybe the one that will show up a little faster and in front of more people was The Selfish Giant, which is also a kind of big change of pace, like Nathaniel was saying about Dolan. This is the second movie by a woman named Clio Bernard from the UK, who previously made a kind of experimental documentary called The Arbor. And The Selfish Giant is a big swerve into fish tank style combination of everything we love about British realism on screen, and it's often pretty tough combined with these fairy tale elements. It's based on a 4-page fairy story by Oscar Wilde that it has modernized and re-dramatized and complicated in all kinds of ways, such that I just read the story and I still was not sure how things were going to go for these characters, who the giant necessarily was. The filmmaking is totally dazzling. It's completely emotionally involving. It was great, and I don't think it was one that it played in a sidebar at Cannes and got really good reviews, but wasn't one that came out of that festival with huge buzz, and I didn't hear a lot of people talking about it at this one, but I was just astonished by it.
I'm kind of glad I didn't pick it up for you too much. I completely loved it, and I was a bit of an Arbor skeptic, so my expectations were not that high, and I agree. I think it's a wonderful film. It might be the best. I mean, depending if we're counting 12 Years a Slave as a British movie, which I think some people will be from these shores, I think The Selfish Giant is the most exciting, truly, entirely British film of the year so far.
I saw The Arbor, so I'm curious. I don't go to TIFF very often, but I found the selection so overwhelming that I missed some very obvious things I would have been interested in.
Yeah, it is routinely hard to sort through how much good stuff there is. Candy store problem.
Yeah, and I really thought The Arbor was fascinating when I saw it, but I found it really stifling almost.
I agree.
The style of it, above and beyond the subject, the oppressive subject matter. I just found the style very, suffocating after a while. Does this one have any problems of, pushing itself too hard?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I Angela, we ran into each other and talked about this on the sidewalk, but I think, had you not seen it?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. But you had heard from other people that Fish Tank was the movie it reminded them of as well?
Yeah, that was the one that kept getting name-checked.
There are a lot of similarities in terms of qualities of the image, but also just sheer investment in young characters and the velocity of the storytelling. So I would never have guessed with 20 tries that it was that director.
I agree with that, yeah. It's the Arbor felt to me extremely acted, which sat a bit strangely given the kind of docudrama elements seemed to me a little bit, just a little bit studied. And this one, her direction of the child is so natural and wonderful. Obviously, she's worked really hard with them, but none of the effort shows.
I guess my next broad question for you guys, which can allow you to talk about some of the, diving into Oscar-y stuff, just about what was not really on your radar before you got to the festival that now you either saw or you're dying to see stuff that kind of took you by surprise in one way or another.
Well, one of the curses of being an Oscar pundit for myself is that I feel like I know too much about it, so I'm rarely surprised when it comes to that element of filmmaking. I mean, I didn't catch a lot because I wasn't there long, but I was trying to catch some of the foreign film submissions. And I missed Ilo Ilo, which I kept hearing really good things about. So I'm thinking that's one to watch for. It'll be the submission from Singapore. Did anybody catch that?
I did, just yesterday. I really liked it a lot, and it's one of those movies that I think as it goes, it seems like a sweet and tender, but maybe not totally distinctive kind of humanist family drama for a while. And it never stops being that, but it feels richer and like it's taking even more chances and balancing things really delicately as it goes. I totally get why people are sold on it, and I'm liking it more even as time goes by.
I can give you one tip, which is don't try and see it, as I did, straight after The Strange Little Cat, because I've just been in this Berlin flat having a delightful time with these animals for 70 minutes and just completely bouncing on a cloud after coming out of that movie. I went into Ilo Ilo, and I could completely admire it, but I was just not wanting to be in this other flat because we used a lot of time. It basically...
You're like, there's no cute animals in this one.
Exactly. I wanted that cat back. I wanted the dog back. So it just wasn't the right moment for me to see that.
Yeah.
In fact, not only is there not a cute animal, there's a kid who's a total pain in the ass.
It is a nightmare, yeah.
And for a while,
I don't know, guys. You're not selling me on this
such
one.
It's a pain in the ass for me to care when you eventually stop being one, but they worked it out.
Yeah.
Speaking of, serendipity and luck, I had a really meticulously planned schedule for my first day, which went to pot. When there was a mishap with my pass, they hadn't printed my pass yet, and it took like an hour for them to print it. It was probably my fault. But what this meant is that I was able to scrap all the stuff I was going to see and instead join Nick to see Norte, The End of History, which is one of his four-hour epics, but a totally riveting one from the Philippines. It's like, this is a saga. It's not a kind of really difficult, austere art house experience. It's actually an incredibly gripping, almost kind of Dickensian narrative about poverty and anger and radicalism and all sorts of things. And I was absolutely thrilled that I got to see that one, because I think probably I would have never got round to it. I don't know when it's going to do more festival rounds. But obviously, that's not really much of an Oscar tip, so perhaps we should move on to something else.
Well, on the foreign film tip again, I'm curious how many people saw Child's Pose, because when I showed up to it, I thought it was going to be one of the hot tickets because, you know, Romanian cinema, everybody is so excited about all the time. And the theater was mostly empty when I saw it.
Really?
Yeah, but I saw it was one of the early morning screenings and on the very first day of the festival, so it could be that people hadn't got there yet or had press pass mishaps like Tim. but it was pretty empty.
Especially for a movie that won Berlin.
Yeah, and I think that might actually have the oomph to get a nomination from foreign film, because I think there's enough elements for that are accessible in it, even if it's challenging as Romanian cinema can be.
But didn't Romania collectively kill the Academy's dog or something in the past and thus never gets nominated?
Something like that.
No, they killed their unborn child in 4 months, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
That's
right. I saw it in Berlin, and I was a little surprised when it took the bear, because I think Gloria was the popular favorite, but they obviously had this dilemma. They didn't want to give best film to Gloria, and then they couldn't give it best actress for the wonderful Paulina Garcia, who was also in TIFF. So I think Charles Post benefited from that slightly, but it was definitely in the kind of top three or four films I saw in Berlin. And it's maybe my favorite Romanian movie since Tuesday After Christmas, which was about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, that was terrific.
Yeah, I think it's the best one since then that I've seen. So yeah, definitely one to catch, whether or not it makes it onto the Oscar shortlist.
I was not as taken with it. I liked it. The questions I had early in the movie were the same questions I still had late in the movie, and I felt like what some people have said about August Osage, that they felt like they were watching actors get to, you know, bite into big opportunities, which is fun as it goes, but I have not lingered on it almost at all since then. Totally liked it, and it's ridiculous that I saw 15 or 20 movies I like better than that, because it's a totally good movie, but...
You had an amazing festival, though. You were just kind of, your Twitter feed was an absolute... kind of avalanche of A's and B pluses and A minuses all the way, wasn't it? You had a great
time.
My
students ought to be happy. I'm coming into the fall just giving everybody A's and B's. School starts tomorrow. Here we go.
They're going to send you to Toronto every year now.
You got it.
Gloria submission for foreign film?
It is, yeah, for Chile.
I think it's got a really strong shout, that one, actually. And Paulina Garcia even has an outside shot, I would say, at a Best Actress nomination. Depending on how they play their cards, it's a wonderful performance. You can see them maybe trying to snap up a remake of that one. And also, the commitment to dealing with the Santiago dating scene and all that might imply in your kind of late middle age, I found extremely touching. It's very funny. And also, it's kind of rigorous, too. I mean, the director has talked about how he decided the story that she actually appears in every single frame of the film. A bit of her is in every frame of the movie. That was his kind of commitment to stylistically do it. And
And that doesn't feel gimmicky? That sounds impossible.
Not at all. I did, because I did not notice until that was told, you know, afterwards by meeting the director. In fact, he talked about it. And I was like, whoa, okay, yeah, I can see that now. But it was sort of, it was subtly enough done that it wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that movie also has a strange little cat, by the way. It's partial to strange little cats.
It really does. You're right, yeah.
This is my favorite running thread of Toronto.
I'm suddenly sad that none of my movies had funny animals in them.
You clearly were not going to the right movies.
That's definitely true.
Besides Ilo Ilo, the other foreign film contenders, well, I think I saw a few, but the one that I'd really watch out for is The Missing Picture from Cambodia, which is kind of in that Waltz with Bashir place where it could be a threat in documentary and in foreign film. The history of the Khmer Rouge's takeover of Cambodia through just the personal reminiscences of Rai Thipan, who's been a pretty major Cambodian filmmaker for like 20 years. But in this film, he mostly does it through clay carvings of people that he's makes on screen. Mm-hmm. And so for about 2/3 of it, you're watching sort of dioramas and reenactments in clay that are incredibly moving, and then there's stock footage kind of woven in and out of that, and his voiceover kind of bridges the whole thing. But it's really moving. It's just distinctive enough because of that approach that I think it will stick out. It makes it seem less maybe of an imposition on people who tend to avoid movies like this because they just don't want to sit for 90 minutes in front of a story that painful. Mm-hmm. So I would look out for that.
Angelo, is there any kind of out of nowhere stunner for you before we dig into mainstream stuff?
I was stunned by how much I didn't like Labor Day. I haven't seen Labor Day.
It was awful. I'm with you on that. I really hated it.
My summer of erotic pies, I've been calling it.
I've seen a lot of pie puns about that movie.
There are a lot of scenes of lovingly making pies, which also serve as lovemaking tutorials. Courtesy of Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Well, I would trust him to know what he's talking about.
Josh showing Kay Winslet how to roll out pastry is sort of the cheesiest sex metaphor since, you know, pottery and ghost. And it's amazing.
Well, I had read that novel, Labor Day, and I the film had a lot of the same problems that the novel did, but, you know, exacerbated the problems by focusing on the boy so much. It was hard to get a read on why the adults were behaving as they were, and they were only trying to fill those gaps with the narration, which is my biggest pet peeve probably in mainstream filmmaking. It's like, oh, we don't have scenes illustrating this, so I'm just going to tell you.
And that's like the Kate Winslet Little Children problem again, right? Where she was kind of giving us Cliff's notes on every scene and reading them out over the top. It was not her fault this time, but I feel as though this kind of sort of unhappy homemaker range of performances we're getting from her needs to kind of take a swerve into something else quite soon.
I'm not begging for her to go back to former typecasting before the unhappy lonely wives, but like she used to play more sort of like free-spirited, you know, bohemian girls. They had a lot of like charisma and energy, and I'm wondering why it seems like it's either or.
Well, there's the reader. She's not a housewife or a bohemian, but that movie had its own problems. I guess I just want to swerve back to 12 Years a Slave, both because that's the one that I've seen, and that is the movie that it seems like nobody could stop talking about at Toronto. And then I saw it here in New York on Tuesday, and it lived up to the hype that surrounded it, which really surprised me. I felt really hard for this movie, and it's been getting so talked about, and it has, you know, moved people so much. And I mean, Tim, you've already talked about how much you like it. For the rest of you guys, does it live up to the enormous expectations that have been put on it, either quality wise and then also awards wise?
I wasn't much of a fan of it, to be honest, but I think I was really taken out of it by all of the celebrity cameos.
Mm. Reminded me of that.
And the band played on, or the Thin Red Line, where you feel all of these celebrities sort of wanting to get involved with a prestige filmmaker, tackling a prestige subject matter. And I don't know, for me, it sort of wore me down and kind of kept pulling me out of the movie in little 15-minute intervals.
I think that's more of a problem toward the beginning of the film. But I think that reached its peak for me with the very early with the Paul Giamatti thing. I was like, why is the celebrity playing this part?
Mm-hmm. Although I mean, at the end when Brad Pitt shows up to save the day, that I did find that jarring too.
Yeah, I can see that being a problem. As soon as he arrived, I was like, uh-oh.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
I thought he was ultimately fine in his two scenes, and at least there weren't too many of them. But the Thin Red Line thing is interesting. I actually think that's a big influence on this movie. Generally, if you listen to Hans Zimmer's score, it often sounds quite like his Thin Red Line score, and it's like in a more subdued way.
It's interesting because Shame has a very similar piece, even though it's not Hans Zimmer. So this is clearly, Journey to the Line is clearly something that Steve McQueen is really trying to sort of angle into each of his movies one at a time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's never a problem for me. That's my favorite movie, so, you know.
Nathaniel, you said you saw it too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. I still think Hunger is his best movie, so I'm maybe not as rapturously in love with it as other people, but I did think it was brilliant, and I loved it, and it'll easily be on my top 10 list. Yeah, the celebrity thing was a tiny, tiny bit of a problem for me, but I just found the performances so riveting. Lupita Nyong'o, who I'm actually interviewing later today, I'm very excited about. She was just, you know, it's the type of part, like, she's going to be a major force in supporting actress this year. It's the type of part where even if she wasn't good, and this is going to sound like an insult, and I don't mean it to be, even if she wasn't good in it, people would latch onto it because the role is so sympathetic and it has, like, the meatiest, like, sort of section of the film in terms of, like, arcs and plot. Happenings, but I think her performance is so cohesive, even though she's, you know, she doesn't get a lot of dialogue, but I really found that her choices from scene to scene, just the character read as such a real person to me in this extreme situation.
The film really clicks into its best focus when it's on that plantation with Fassbender and Sarah Paulson and Lupita. But yeah, there's some great work all the way through the film, I think.
At this point in the podcast, we had some technical difficulties, so we're jumping ahead. We're talking about the first sequence, which is a cross-cut flashback in which the main character, Solomon, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, is trying to write a letter.
The way he sort of decides to tell its story is through his struggle with actually putting a single word on a single page, and I thought that worked.
Yeah, I mean, talk about an elegant use of referring to the fact that this is based on a book compared to how most movies do it.
Exactly, yeah.
So, based on a novel pushed by Sapphire, is that what we're talking about?
Well, just, I mean, it's just usually so heavy-handed when something is adapted and you get sort of like, I mean, in old school days, you'd actually get the book opening before you'd see the visuals, but...
Or as in James Franco's Child of God, you see pages of the novel just on the screen for you in giant font. It's not quite as giant as the font for Directed by James Franco, but still giant.
Man. Yeah, that movie sounds ridiculous, and I'm seeing it on Tuesday. I can't wait.
I'm going to say one thing about 12 Years
as please.
I did not see it, but was in Toronto, because I just feel like I've gotten a sense from social media that there may be a perception that everybody in Toronto who's excited about 12 Years a Slave was excited in a way that was totally contained within Oscar obsession, and that there were kind of strategic or buzz-related reasons than that it was like naive to turn that movie totally into a conversation about awards. And there's been some griping about that. And I just want to say, as somebody who was there, every conversation I heard people having about that movie was actually about how amazing it was. It wasn't really a place where you were suddenly the whole conversation of the town turned to like why this might win or what kind of awards narrative it makes possible. Like, it really was about the quality of the movie. Just want to say that.
I'm glad to hear you say that. And in fact, the first thing anyone was pronouncing on was just how great it was. I must agree. Although I will admit that I put a bet on the movie later on that night, as Nick knows, and only to watch its odds collapse in the next kind of 2 or 3 days. So yeah, I am in my own way profiting off of slavery.
So long as you're open about it.
It's funny how the awards narrative can, you know, mess with, you know, pure intentions at film festivals. Although obviously a lot of the reasons, you know, that people show movies at festivals is to build awards buzz,
especially at this one,
right? You know, it's funny because like when I saw it here, and I'm not going to name the person because I don't mean this as a slight as them, but I was sitting next to somebody who I know from online, and the second the movie ended, so that's, you know, and then it was immediately a question about Best Picture. And I was just kind of ticked off because I was still sort of like so emotionally overwhelmed by it that I wasn't like, you know, as Tim and Nick are saying, I wasn't actually thinking about the Oscars as it concluded, which is, you know, a plus for the movie. But then I got home and I, you know, started writing about it, and I ended up writing about the Oscars, and I was like, God damn it.
We all have this self-hating instinct that just kicks in eventually.
But it does, like, for people sitting at home, it provides such a good organizational principle for some of these movies. Like, when you talk about, you know, August Osage County comes, and you're telling me what kind of Oscar chances it has, tells me a lot about how successful this adaptation is. And 12 Years a Slave, I think Tim was talking about this earlier, you know, if it's traditional Steve McQueen, high style, you know, very alienating, like, it really wouldn't have gotten this buzz. So when that started, that really kind of framed what to expect from that movie for me, and I found it really accurate.
There's been some implication that maybe he's really gone for Oscar bait, and he's tailored himself to like, right, this is my
no.
Oscar movie.
No, not at all.
I think his first priority is to the story, and actually the style really does suit the story really well.
And it's actually of a piece with his other movies, but it's still very much a Steve McQueen film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't suddenly become, you know, Ron Howard or something.
Although, Ron Howard made a pretty good movie that was at Toronto, too. Did anybody else see Rush? It's very entertaining, and it's very flashy, but I like the movie, and I really like Daniel Brühl, and I was excited to see him get to do a big role like that.
Yeah, it's true. It seems to be his year, although he's better cast in Rush than he was in The Fifth Estate, I felt, where it was like he was inhabiting a different movie from... In Rush, I was actually more surprised by how much I liked Chris Hemsworth in it, who I thought was just going to be kind of lightweight movie star carrying the thing. And in fact, I found his kind of impersonation of a certain era of British charm really, really convincing and kind of well-crafted. And, you know, a good hats off to him.
Yeah, I liked Hemsworth too. I've been rooting for him for a while. I didn't mean to swerve the conversation. Swerve, like Rush, away from 12 Years a Slave. But Tim, you brought up The Fifth Estate. Is that movie, I don't know how many of you guys saw that, is it a total dog? Like, everything I've heard about it is just a total brush off.
I didn't think it was a dog. I thought it was just extremely so... That saving it is actually Benedict Cumberbatch, who... I was worried from everything I'd seen, all the stills and stuff, that it was just going to be a kind of party trick performance. And actually, I think he is really good in it. He's kind of better than the movie deserves. A lot of other stuff in the film doesn't really work. There are subplots that seem like totally functional and don't add very much. And there's some sort of misfiring supporting roles. But he is front and center and fascinating. And I thought that was sort of enough for the film to hang itself on. But, you know, it's not totally well thought through as a movie, and I think it's full of these weird conflicts, some of which it admits to, and ironies. I found it kind of fun to grapple with from a review point of view, because there was so much there that was kind of going wrong, but then there were other things that were almost accidentally right, and yeah, I found it an interesting one to write about.
I'm going to interrupt with a question.
Please.
In
your own podcast? What the hell?
Well, I was just wondering if anybody had an experience with a movie where they just weren't receiving it the way other people were receiving it, because I just had such trouble connecting to Gravity, and this isn't a question about Gravity per se, but it seemed like everybody thought it was the greatest, and I just couldn't. I was wowed by the visuals, but nothing else.
I was surprised by what Gravity actually was. I was surprised that it was sort of received as, you know, a really almost austere prestige picture when, to me, it felt almost like a really good technical demonstration with almost nothing else on its mind. I mean, I feel like it's doing a very narrow thing, and it's doing it pretty well. But I was sort of shocked by how it was received as being something, I think, perhaps more serious than it actually was or than it actually struck me.
Mm-hmm. In a way, I feel the same way about a good film, Stranger by the Lake, kind of French gay drama, which I just heard such rhapsodizing about from Cannes that I thought it was going to be a really serious deal. And actually, much as I admire the film's craft, and I think it's like totally hot, and it's, I would recommend it to anyone, there was something kind of fundamentally not very plausible about it, and kind of thrillerish. In a slightly lurid, hokey way, which maybe dragged my enthusiasm down a notch. With Gravity, I completely hear what you're saying, particularly about the first maybe reel or two of the film, where everything seems to happen rather arbitrarily, and the film doesn't seem to really kind of give it much weight, as it were. It seems a weightless film from the word go, and then it eventually builds its own. It builds gravity, it builds weight, it builds drama as it goes along. But at the front, I thought it was throwing things away, and it was also kind of putting the characters in positions too early, which then undercut our kind of dread and their kind of jeopardy later on. So I thought, in terms of construction, even though sort of sequence by sequence is brilliant, I thought there was some failings there as well.
Anyone else? Expectations versus how you've received it.
I have a kind of ongoing Sylvain Chomet problem where I like his movies, but I kind of stop maybe at the level of technical execution. Also, as you guys were saying about Gravity, that I felt that way for slightly different reasons, but I've nonetheless felt that way about Belleville and then again about Illusionist and certainly about Attila Marcel, which is his live action debut, which showed in Toronto. And I will be amazed if I read more than 3 reviews of that movie when it comes out that don't mention Amelie. And with a slightly cipherish and male ingenue in the middle. But I think what he brings in terms of visual ideas to all 3 of his movies, it's so clear how painstaking he's been about what to cram into each frame and what he's alluding to and what music he's incorporating. And it's really impressive. And the film is warm in a sense. But I find his conception of people just really kind of cold. There's like a whole domestic abuse plot line through this movie. It involves the main character's parents, and we get all these clues that the father was beating the mother for quite some time. But later, there's just a reason we shouldn't worry so much about that. Like, what? And it's mostly to make a plot thing happen, and I think that Chomet will do almost anything to make a plot thing happen in all of his movies, and the plot thing that happens is usually not so plausible or interesting, especially in comparison to what it costs you in terms of being able to get into the story, at least for me. So there was a ton of laughter in the audience I saw it with. People adored the movie. I kind of felt admiring but slightly chilly again.
I was surprised about the Denis Villeneuve films because the one that came in as sort of the prestige film is Prisoners, which I thought was pretty ridiculous. But the one that I sort of ended up liking was Enemy, the one that almost nobody is talking about. Because it's this sort of eminently hateable, very strange movie with Jake Gyllenhaal as like a U of T history professor and his low-level actor double, which is essentially the double, but more minor than the double somehow. But that was the one no one seemed to be talking about, and that was the one that I found was surprisingly really fun and really low-key and kind of enjoyably minor in a way.
Mm-hmm. I liked that too. I mean, it felt a little disposable to me, despite how weirdly haunting it is. Like, I'm still remembering sequences, right. Which is a good sign after, you know, cramming a bunch of movies together in a short amount of time. But I did really like the performances, and I liked how just committed it was to this very sort of mindfuck.
Speaking of the double, did any of you guys catch that one? I heard some really excited stuff, but really briefly, and then I didn't hear anything else about it.
Yeah, I saw it. And I really loved the style, and I thought it was Richard Ayoade kind of revealing his true enthusiasms in a way that Submarine didn't quite. Because I going back to his like TV work, he had a series called Garth Marenghi's Dark Place in 2004, which I completely loved. And it felt like it was building a little world in the same way that that did. And I love the way it was crafted, but I just found the kind of switchbacks within the narrative about which character had the upper hand at any point, if any care about, and I sort of tuned out of it after maybe an hour. So in the end, I was left with a slight sense of disappointment. I think it also starts out funny, and it doesn't really end funny.
People seem to really like that one, though.
Yeah, most people like it more than I did, and I kind of tried to be fairly even-handed writing about it.
Angela, you said something hilarious about Mia Wasikowska. Whatever it is she's doing in this movie, I don't understand, but I think I like it.
She's doing a kind of Julie Delpy thing, I think. I'm not really sure what she's doing. Her accent keeps fluctuating, and I think it's on purpose, but yeah, it's very strange and discombobulating. I sort of liked her, I think, more than Eisenberg, even.
I'd maybe go along with that. She also has an excellent blue cardigan, which is very good.
Which is important.
I was really taken with Sarah Gadon. Is that how you say her name? Gadon?
I have no idea.
The Canadian actress?
Yeah, I don't know.
You say Her Highness Princess Sarah Gadon.
She's in both Enemy and Belle, and possibly every other thing made in Canada in the past 5 years.
The F word, actually. She has one scene in the F word, too.
Yeah, and she's been in like all the recent Cronenbergs, including I saw accidentally, I saw two of her movies back to back, and I like her odd range for someone who looks so blankly pretty.
Yeah, Nathaniel, you suggested talking about double features, like movies that are existing in the same space in your head for whatever reason, because
good
festivals
segue.
Tend to do that. I know, I feel like he planned this himself. So you had a Sarah Gadon double feature. Was there anything else that, like movies that are existing in the same space in your head?
Well, my other one is we've already discussed, so we can fly right by it, but Tom at the Farm and Stranger by the Lake, and not just for their titles. I really connect in my head, but they're both, you know, gay thrillers with erotic elements.
So at least that's
both
a logical connection.
And they're both very good. Yeah, those are more logical connection because Belle and Enemy have literally nothing in common besides her royal princess, Sarah Gadon.
Well, that could be a three-way because there's also Eastern Boys, which is a gay thriller with erotic elements, which I think I liked a lot more than Stranger by the Lake.
Nick, you saw that one too, didn't you?
I think that both of those movies, I didn't see Tom at the Farm, but Stranger by the Lake and Eastern Boys kind of don't make sense if you don't attribute a certain amount of gay shame to the protagonists. Mm-hmm. About what they think they should be allowed or have to put up with for being gay in some sense. But Eastern Boys dramatizes that in an incredibly fascinating way, especially in its first half hour. My double feature came out of one movie that's called Closed Curtain, which is the most recent movie by Jafar Panahi, who made This Is Not a Film, and remains on all of our minds for continuing to be under house arrest in Iran, and is still thinking of ways to make movies when he's not allowed to leave the house. And there have been mixed opinions about that movie, so you should definitely go see it to make up your mind. But comes up with this kind of meta-drama inside his house about whether he's just going along too easily with house arrest or whether he's making too austere a movie and should take more chances. There's all kinds of interrogating of his own position. But I knew about that movie going in. I did not know about this Syrian movie called Ladder to Damascus that I saw, which is not only about 12 people living in an apartment complex in Damascus as the uprising begins, wondering whether they should go outside, whether they can live with themselves not participating in the uprising, whether they should go looking for people when they don't come home. But in fact, the movie was made during the uprising, 70 meters away from the National Security Outpost, and no one was allowed to have script pages because if they got kidnapped, they would have to explain them. They couldn't recite all their lines of dialogue because they might be overheard across the street, so they would just have to say something else or just move their mouths and loop it later so that the police would not hear this politically contentious movie being made. They're both fascinating stories about trying to comment on the outside world without being allowed to go into it. And I really hope Ladder to Damascus shows up lots of places later because it's captivating.
I feel like Amour has kicked off a mini trend of foreign films about people in apartments, or pets in apartments, as the case may be.
Maybe a double feature in my head is two of the movies that I actually walked out of because I had pressing things to review. In one case, I had pressing things to review. That was Dom Hemingway, the Jude Law vehicle, which I just found intolerable. I watched maybe 45 minutes of it and then realized, no, they could really do with my review of The Double now, so I better scoot. And I did not regret that for a second. And apparently, it got even worse. So that one was one. And then the other one was the slightly notorious screening of Mandela, which after 40 minutes, they basically stopped for reasons that have not been entirely clarified. I found it pretty dreary from what I saw, and I think there's maybe a little bit of anxiety about what the critical reaction is going to be ultimately.
Yeah, that's it. When I was talking about Oscar buzz helping you sort things from afar, like when basically I heard nothing about Mandela after it had opened, it became very clear to me that there was not enough enthusiasm behind that for anyone to even want to talk about it, which is a shame, but I guess not unexpected.
Yeah, I felt that way about Railway Man, which I did see, but I didn't hear anybody else talking about it.
I saw that too. I did actually write about that one, but it was not a successful movie. It was just basically the book very kind of respectfully handled, I think. And there'll be some interest in it over here, because I think Eric Lomax is a name that people conjure with over in the British press. But yeah, that's not going to travel very well.
I was going to hijack just briefly to say nobody said anything about Under the Skin, which is the other movie that and 12 Years a Slave were the two movies that everybody seemed to be talking about in Toronto. Sure. So we may not have to get into it now, but...
Sure, just pour salt in my wounds. That was also undoable for me due to my flight.
It's amazing. Sorry. More salt.
You would think they would schedule these things around you, Nathaniel. They need to understand.
I know. You know what was really strange, and this is a good sign, even though the person was snippy with me, but the first review that I saw of Under the Skin was very, like, negative. And I just tweeted that, you know, after the response to Birth, I won't trust any reviews of this until I see it for myself. You know, because Birth was so roundly trashed, and... Mm-hmm. One person wrote, and he was like, what are you talking about? People think Birth is a masterpiece. Like, people didn't hate that movie. What are you talking about? You know, implying that I was very ignorant. And I was like, no, I actually lived through that, and it actually got terrible reviews.
Yeah, right. I am a survivor of that period of time.
I was there.
It was good in Venice, right? Yeah.
And I loved it at the time, and people were just like, oh, this movie sucks. And so, like, no matter what bad reviews I read of filmmaker... I don't know how you say his last name. Is it Glazer?
Glazer, yeah.
Glazer. You know, not going to trust it until I see it. So it's heartening to hear from people I trust that it's amazing, but I still need to see it with my own eyeballs.
This can only go so far, but I would say it's probably something like the Holy Motors of this year, that not just because of its kind of elliptical relationship to a protagonist who's constantly in front of your face, but it just is thinking in a different way about what a movie might be. And I think it's probably going to be rejected on those grounds by some audiences. I think it might get overpraised just for thinking outside the box in ways that don't always help it. It makes it a little uncomfortable when it gets back inside a box for a minute.
Yeah.
But it's pretty astonishing as an exercise.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, it's a much more impressive formal exercise than Gravity, I would say. They sort of struck me as similar movies in the sense that they're both doing something very specific, very deliberately, but Under the Skin was much more impressive for me.
Thanks, everybody, for coming to discuss TIFF. For people who have never been, I have been once before, but I felt very a steep learning curve with a press pass, and it can be a very overwhelming festival. So for listeners who might want to go to Toronto, for a sign off, if you could give them a word of advice about 2014 and what's the best way to approach this massive great festival. Thanks everybody for coming. Katie.
The last time that I went to Toronto last year, I didn't get in town until Sunday, and I was there through Friday, which, if you've been, you know, is kind of the quieter half of a festival. And I actually found that a really good way to catch random movies, because the Silver Linings Playbooks and the Argos and all that was gone, and I could catch, the reality, the guy who made Jesus, the guy who made Gamora. Thank you.
Garone.
I was like, I have film festival brain. Anyway, it gave me a chance to catch smaller stuff like that that it wouldn't necessarily open for a while. So back half of the festival, it's underrated. Use it to your advantage.
Nick?
You need an hour between movies? I did not have a press pass and have not either of the times that I've gone. And I actually think I might just continue to not apply for them because Toronto audiences are the best. Nobody thinks it's weird to strike up conversations before or after. I met so many completely interesting people who had all kinds of movies I hadn't paid much attention to in the program who had really interesting things to say about them. And I was just really glad that I didn't have any... like, you know, editor or anything I had to respond to about what I was having to see. And there's just so much on offer. So, be creative when you go. Mix it up.
And thanks to our special guest. So we'll start with Angelo.
Thank you. I would just say make friends with people in the rush line, sort of following from what Nick said there. They tend to see a lot of strange things that you might not have heard of and tend to have better advice than you might expect if you're seeing public screenings, that is.
And Tim?
If you're getting to stay in a hotel, as Nick and I did, eat the breakfast for like an hour and shovel the bananas into your bag, they may be helpful during the day.
You guys have extremely practical tips about food and survival.
I should have done that. I was always racing out of my hotel, which did have complimentary breakfast, and I never grabbed a banana or anything, which was insane of me because I was always crazy hungry later.
Saved a lot of money on lunch.